welcome to All Have a Beer and Talk, a show that I make just about every week in an undisclosed location somewhere underneath Portland, Oregon, that I have a really hard time explaining simply. Here's the meandering long version of what the show is about. I like beer, and I like technology. So much so that I like to talk about those things. There's only so much of that my friends and family can handle, so I made a show where I record myself doing just that and offer it to complete strangers to listen to. I choose a random craft beer, try to tell you a little bit about the style, what it tastes like, and maybe some interesting facts about its history. Then I proceed to drink it, giving you my honest reaction. Then I talk about six technology-related stories that I found interesting that I read on the internet over the previous week, and one funny and or weird animal-related story, all in the time it takes me to finish the beer. If you, the listeners at home, can come up with a quicker and or more elegant way of explaining all that, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckle.com, or tweet me at ihabatradio, or post something on facebook.com/ihabatradio. So, enough of that. Let's get to that beer, because I have a vast and varied collection of beers from across the country, and actually from across the planet. I use a device called the Randomizer, which you are hearing right now, to make a random selection from that collection. Ooh, the Randomizer has selected Cuvée 800, a 5.5% ABV Belgian pale ale from the brewery of the Abbey of Valdeux in Abel, Belgium. According to beeradvocate.com, this beer was brewed once, so I have a collector's item to drink here. Belgian pale ales were originally brewed to compete with Pilsners in the 1940s, if you can believe it. They are less bitter than regular pale ales, use aged hops for a milder finish, and have malt overtones that range from sweet to toasty. Beer Advocate recommends that I decant this properly by leaving the yeast in the bottle, so I will attempt that right now. Do not be alarmed by the following sound. It is simply the noise I choose to mask the transition to the beer mic. It's a pale yellow with a white head and smells very, very crisp, almost like a champagne. I wonder if it tastes like one. Let's find out. Belgians, man. Wow. It's like totally, perfectly, completely balanced between bitterness and sweetness and just so crisp and cool and refreshing. It is perfect for a day like today where it's about, 85 degrees Fahrenheit outside. Yum, yum. And I successfully kept the yeast in the bottle, so that's actually a good thing. It could come in handy if I need to clean up some heavy metal pollution. That's what the American Council on Science and Health says. Romanian and Norwegian researchers published their research on using yeast for bioremediation in the journal Applied Microbiology and Biotechnology. Bioremediation is the use of biological organisms to clean up polluted areas. And according to the ACSH article, the field is real hot right now. Heavy metal pollution in the natural environment is a result of industrial processes, and heavy metals are quite toxic to humans and other animals. So sites that have been contaminated need to be cordoned off until they can be properly cleaned up. Conventional techniques are expensive and time-consuming, so that's why bioremediation holds such promise. Some plants can naturally soak up heavy metals found in the soil in which their roots grow, but A. Plants can't grow large enough to deal with heavily contaminated areas, and B, plants can't clean up polluted water. That's where the yeasties come into play. The researchers took some Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which, as you should know, is common baker's yeast, and attached a new protein to the inner side of the yeast's cell membranes. The researchers created the protein from a cell membrane anchor, one of three kinds of metal-binding peptides, and, to make sure the attachment worked, a green fluorescent protein that glows green when exposed to UV light. The researchers then let the modified yeasties go wild, testing their new abilities to soak up various metals. Yeasts that were bonded with aspartate and glutamate soaked up copper and manganese. Yeasts with cysteine loved hoovering up cadmium and silver. And histidine peptides hitching ride inside yeasties loved taking up cobalt and nickel. At their best, the metal-loving yeasts were able to remove about 80% of the favored metals in the special environment set up for the lab tests. So what's next for the yeast metalheads? The researchers need to test the yeast's effectiveness in real-world locations, and they need to figure out how to deal with the yeasties after they had filled themselves up with toxic metal. You would not want to brew beer with them. You would die drinking it. Anyway, let's hear it for the magical beastie, the yeastie. Hooray! MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, also known as CSAIL, think they can create the Shazam for food, in which one could conceivably take a photo of a dish to determine its ingredients and recipe. So, unlike Not Hot Dog, this potential app could actually be useful. As detailed in a post at news.mit.edu, CSAIL and the Qatar Computing Research Institute, also known as QCRI, trained an artificial intelligence system called Pick2Recipe to analyze photos of food to try to deduce the ingredients and search for, then provide, suggested recipes. The paper on the research will be presented later this month at the hottest conference of the year, the Computer Vision and Pattern Recognition Conference in Honolulu, Hawaii. MIT postdoc Yusuf Attar said, "In computer vision, food is mostly neglected because we don't have the large-scale datasets needed to make predictions. But seemingly useless photos on social media can actually provide valuable insight into health habits and dietary preferences." So it's a good thing that snake people constantly take photos of their avocado toast and other fine meals, because that means that the researchers have a large sample of food images to work with. There have been a few research attempts at doing this before. In 2014, Swiss researchers created a dataset called Food 101, and with it created an algorithm that was about 50% accurate in recognizing images of food, with further improvements only bringing that success rate up to about 80%, unfortunately, with a relatively small size of the data pointed to as a limiting factor. Large datasets can help. The City University in Hong Kong developed a system that contained over 110,000 images and 65,000 recipes, but their system only works with Chinese food. Hong Kong, Chinese food. Makes sense. The Pick2Recipe system is far more ambitious. CSAIL scoured recipe websites like AllRecipes and Food.com to develop a database containing over 1 million recipes with annotations about the ingredients across the entire dataset, which they named Recipe 1M. The team then used a neural network to find patterns in the food images and the corresponding ingredients and recipes and make connections between the two. In testing, Pick2Recipe was successful at identifying ingredients such as flour, eggs, and everyone's favorite, butter, from photos of food items and was able to suggest several recipe options that the system determined would produce food similar to what appeared in the initial photo. The system does well with desserts, like cookies or muffins, as the main theme of the database was centered on baked items, but understandably, it could not compute photos of different food types like, and these are the examples from the article, sushi rolls or smoothies. You know, I'd be hard-pressed to tell you what is in a smoothie just by looking at it too, so I can't fault it for that weakness. It also had issues when there were similar recipes for foods. Given a photo of lasagna, it was overwhelmed by the sheer amount of lasagna recipes in the Recipe 1M database. The team believes that this can be rectified by having the algorithm compare the ingredients of each recipe to see if they are generally similar before comparing the full recipes. The ultimate goal is to develop a system that can help people not only cook their own food, but also have more accurate ways of tracking their daily nutrition. Instead of keeping a food journal, they can just take photos of what they're eating. I would recommend, though, that MIT add a function to Pick2Recipe that would automatically post the food photos to Instagram, because that would save sneak people a lot of time. Quick, stare at a bright blank thing like a bare wall or a blank sheet of paper. See any weird squiggly things rolling across the side of your vision? Don't worry, those aren't alien worms, those are called floaters. They are tiny clumps of protein that float in the gel in the back of your eye. You know, that gel is called the vitreous humor. Remember that if you want to win pub trivia night. Anyway, those floaties are normal. I have a couple that are annoying, but not too bad right now. But they do increase in frequency, number, and size as you age. For the past 15 years, laser treatments have been available, but no one has studied the effectiveness of the laser treatment compared to placebos. Until now. A paper was published on this exact thing this week in JAMA Ophthalmology by the Ophthalmic Consultants of Boston. 52 patients were recruited for the research for the paper and put into experimental and control groups, as proper researchers do with their subjects. 36 patients were treated with pulses from a specific type of laser light called YAG laser vitriolysis. These 16 patients in the control group were given the placebo. A special filter was used, and the laser was operated at its lowest intensity, resulting in no laser light actually entering the affected patient's eyes. 34 out of the 36 patients in the laser group lost most or all of their floaters, which is pretty significant since the patients in the non-laser group didn't lose any at all. Now, don't start shining laser pointers into your eyes if you have a few floaters. Many have pointed out some limitations on the study. It was pretty small, with only 52 patients. The patients themselves were selected carefully by the test makers. The study only lasted 6 months, and the YAG laser treatment was only compared to a placebo and not any of the other laser treatments available. But it's good to know that there are non-invasive treatments actually available for me right now. Cool ones involving lasers. Now, papermaking doesn't directly involve lasers, but it is equally as cool. You can learn all about it at this show's sponsor, Pulp & Deckel. Pulp & Deckel is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio, and its mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, and by creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products. Browse the rotating selection of papermaking workshops, check out membership options, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. If you like what you see, mention I'll have a beer and talk, and we might give you something special. Quick, look up into the sky! Don't look directly at the sun, but be aware that the sun will be obscured by a total solar eclipse this August 21st, 2017. This is the first full solar eclipse viewable in the Americas since 1979, and will be observable in 14 states, with 12 states lucky enough to be in its direct path. Oregon is one of those states, and since my wife and I are based in Portland, Oregon, we and some of our wacky friends will be at a party house a bit closer to the coast to watch the cosmic ballet go on for a whole 2 minutes. According to information I gathered from an article at Digital Trends, I will also be able to, briefly, hold one of my dream jobs, that of being an unpaid scientific advisor to NASA. Yes, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration wants my help, and yours, and, well, anyone's help, in collecting data during the eclipse. It has been known that during an eclipse, temperature and cloud conditions change very quickly, and for unclear reasons, animals get eerily quieter than normal. NASA would like to take the opportunity of the observable eclipse happening in such a wide swath of populated areas by asking the public to gather information with their personal smart devices. The public will have an opportunity to participate in a nationwide science experiment by collecting cloud and temperature data from their phones, NASA announced. NASA's Global Learning and Observations to Benefit the Environment, also known as GLOBE Program Observer, is a citizen science project that allows users to record observations with a free app. Armed with the app and a thermometer, participants can help. If you are interested, you just need to download the Globe Observer app from your chosen phone's app marketplace and learn more about the Globe program at observer.globe.gov. That is OBSERVER.GLOBE.GOV. By participating, I think that means I can officially add NASA scientist to my resume, right next to my theoretical degree in physics. The technology category of wearables may have slowed way down, but Engadget reports that hasn't stopped Atari from jumping on that very slow bandwagon. Yes, that's right, Atari. It's back from the dead. As the debut product for its Atari Connected Life consumer wearable electronics product line, Atari has unveiled the Speaker Hat, which does exactly what it says on the tin. It is a baseball cap with Bluetooth-enabled high-quality speakers embedded in the bill. So, it's a wearable stereo? Curiously, it also incorporates a microphone, so it could be used as a hands-free phone headset, except your conversations would play out of those speakers. There are no embedded headphones. Just what I want to see and hear on public transportation. Atari also has stated that they will be bringing a, quote, fundamentally new social audio experience with something called multiplayer mode. Essentially, it will allow multiple users to listen via Bluetooth a single audio stream. so the hat's Bluetooth must have some kind of multi-point broadcast aspect. Which is interesting tech, but I'm not sure incorporating it into a hat is the wisest and best choice. Atari will also offer a limited edition speaker hat to tie in with the new Blade Runner 2049 film this fall, so there's that, too. I think it's only a matter of time before either this fails, or a fast food company does a co-branding with the Atari speaker hat. It screams of pizza tech, wouldn't you agree? I bet you were thinking about elephant seals just now. And look, Gizmodo has a story about elephant seals! Gizmit. A new study published in Current Biology points to the conclusion that elephant seals may be able to recognize, based on tone and rhythm, their rivals' calls. Maintaining dominance is integral to the social order of elephant seals, so this isn't too much of a surprise. But believe it or not, observing animals perceiving rhythm is quite rare. This is the first natural example where, on a daily basis, an animal uses the memory and the perception of rhythm to recognize other members of the population, stated study co-author Nicholas Mathivon of Université de Lyon/Saint-Étienne. That's obviously in France. Researchers spent weeks at Ano Nuevo State Park in California studying an elephant seal colony. They identified the alpha male and recorded his call. Then they induced audio trickery to alter the tone and rhythm of the call and played it and the original recording back to 10 beta male members of the colony. When hearing the original recording by the original artist, all 10 males scattered in fear. But when hearing the altered recordings, the beta males showed no fear, like Daredevil. In case you don't know what elephant seals sound like, here's a little clip. Enjoy. So now that you've heard that, I think you can tell why being able to recognize the tone and rhythm of specific calls would be very important and also quite difficult if you aren't familiar with the elephant seal language. It's important for elephant seals to recognize specific member calls due to the violent structure of their society. Knowing who is yelling can prevent, well, death. It is possible that maybe the ability to perceive rhythm is actually very general in animals, Mathivon said. But it's extremely important for elephant seals, to the point of survival. Competing for females, the males fight very violently, even to the point of killing one another. So it's very important for them to accurately recognize the voices and to be able to choose the right strategy, to know to avoid a fight with a dominant male, or even to start a fight with an inferior one. So, very much like in human life, just stay away from the yelling ones. And speaking of animal aggression and society, Ars Technica had a nice little story about brain implants in mice allowing them to achieve higher social status through induced aggression. In a recent article in Science, Zhao Tingting, a neuroscientist from the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Shanghai, detailed his and his team's experiments with behaviors in mice. They measured mouse dominance by putting them through the tube test, in which mice are put in opposite ends of a narrow tube. There isn't enough room for mice to pass by each other without pushing other mice aside. The mouse who shoves the most mice out of the way is considered to be the most dominant and has a high level on the male mice's pecking order. The most interesting fact from this article for me was that the most dominant mice aren't really the strongest mice, they're just the most persistent in getting their way. In the article, Zhao and his team wrote that winner mice initiated significantly more pushes, and with a longer duration per push, than loser mice. Take that, losers! The researchers analyzed the brain activity of the mice and found that the winner mice showed higher brain activity in the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, also known as DMPFC, than in the loser mice. The DMPFC is associated with, quote, effortful behavior and, quote, social dominance. So they did what any good scientist would. They decided to stimulate the DMPFC in the loser mice. They surgically inserted an implant into the loser mice's skulls, which would allow the researchers to use optogenetics, which can trigger neural activity with proteins and light, to give the DMPFC a little kickstart. The loser mice became more assertive immediately, shoving the winner mice repeatedly out of the way, winning the tube shove battle every time. So that's great, but what if the implant stops working? Do they return to being more mouse than man mouse? Evidently not. After having their DM PFCs directly stimulated more than 6 times to win the tube test, some of the loser mice no longer needed the boost to win. This is referred to as the winner effect, in which one success can lead to further successes due to a positive change in the individual's outlook. Being in a feedback loop where engaging in new behavior consistently provides reward, the brain rewires itself due to its plasticity. Reworking the neural pathways like this doesn't require implants. It can be done naturally through learning, but the implant speeds up the process dramatically. Now, mouse brains are quite similar to human brains, so it's remotely possible this technique could work in other mammals and humans, but human brains are way more complex than mouse brains. It would probably cause more problems than solutions if used in a human brain. Still, I am throwing money at the screen to get one of these things implanted into my DM PFC. Aggro for Algernon. Greetings, friends. Do you wish to sound as happy as me when I make this show? That's thanks to my sponsors on Patreon. But you too have the power to support me right now, so use it and help me produce this show. You can hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpandeckel.com. That is GARY@PULPANDECKLE.com. Rates are reasonable. And if you could be so kind to rate and review the show on iTunes, the more I have at discoverability will go up for people looking for Beery Tech Podcasts on iTunes. And you can also support the show directly with money. If you enjoy my show each week, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. Go to patreon.com/ihabitradio and become my patron. You'll be joining the very attractive and talented group that already support me. Kapla! And I have finished the Cuvée 800, and there is no more. Oh well, it was great. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, plants, aliens, elephants, seals, and agro mice about the show, and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpandeckel.com, or on Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio, or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!